Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
If you like this show, you need to check out the Real GM Football Podcast, hosted by Jeff Risden. Join Jeff each week as he features wide-ranging and in-depth conversation with the NFL's best thought leaders. They talk salary cap, draft, and even a bit of fantasy. So check out the Real GM Football Podcast weekly on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Welcome on to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is the final of the Division Capsule podcasts for Real GM Radio, ending with the Southeast Division and a great pairing of guests. The first time I've ever had these two on together. Andrew Sharp of Sports Illustrated and Mike Prada of SB Nation. Two guys that actually know each other pretty well due to running in wizard circles, but they both, of course, know this division well. Go in a lot of different directions with this. While all of the questions that are a part of these, if you've listened to the other ones in the series, are included in here, they're not necessarily in the same order or distributed. The time is not distributed evenly. We do a little bit of short shrift, I guess you could say, to the preview part of it, but we pretty much agreed, so there wasn't as much really to discuss on that part of it, but still a lot of interesting threads and discussions about not only this division, but where the league is going. So I think you'll really enjoy it. This episode is brought to you by betonline.ag. If you use the promo code podcast1, you get a 50% sign-up bonus, which is great. Pluto TV, the leading free streaming television service. And our friends at TrueCar, great place to buy new and used cars. This episode runs about hour 20. Think you'll really enjoy it. Thank you guys so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having us. God, this division is so depressing.
I like how Mike and I have done these with different guests over the years, and it feels like there's always some sort of malaise, but this year's malaise is different because I feel like it's division-wide. Is that fair, Mike?
Yeah, this division's awful. I mean, we were just talking beforehand. The Wizards are not exactly a team people are excited about this year, and they're probably the best team in the division. So that kind of tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, if we're talking about malaise, let's go full disclosure here, okay? So before this podcast, you sent out an email about the Atlantic Division, and I started looking over the Atlantic Division, and, you know, the Celtics, Raptors, and Sixers are three really good teams, and then I realized that we were going to be doing the Southeast, and there's the Wizards, the Heat, and then I started thinking, and I know the Hornets are in the Southeast Division, but I don't know if I can name another Southeast Division team. And there's got to be more, but like the Southeast Division is really kind of where like excitement goes to die in the last couple of years, and you know, that's fine. I guess Orlando is in there too. It's kind of rough.
And even though the conceit of my whole podcast for Real GM Radio in the summer is on divisions, this division makes me, it furthers my argument, which I've had independent of this for a long time, that there just shouldn't be divisions. Because you're sitting there going, I mean, thankfully they fixed the benefits of it that you don't automatically get a three seed now. Like, think about how that could work out with this one now. I mean, especially.
I miss that. As a Wizards fan, I miss those days.
Can you imagine if, like, the Raptors got the sixth seed because of the way the divisions are set up?
just like out and out riot. Well, no, because if they got the sixth seed, then they would like think what I was thinking about was like if we imagine Boston gets the one, if it was Philly Toronto in the 4-5 because of that.
Oh, yeah,
so then
true.
So right. Then Philly, yeah, that's what I, if that right. Had been the case, Philly Toronto and Boston would have all been on the same side of the bracket.
God, what if they went full the other way though? What if they did the baseball strategy where like a massive proportion of your games are against division teams, and so these teams pick up big records while beating up on each other, and then they get high seeds, and then they have to play these better teams in the playoffs. What if that was the system?
It could work, but I mean, you'd be shifting the proportions. I mean, that would be really good for these teams because not they would presumably be taking games away from the West. Probably you'd do that. I mean, interleague in baseball is a much smaller proportion of the schedule, so that would be good for them. Yeah, it'd definitely be different.
Yeah. We've just figured out how to get the Wizards 50 wins for the first time since 1978.
Yeah. All of this stuff would be great for teams in this hapless division, but just bad for the sport in general. Nobody needs more Wizards magic game, even though I enjoy the Harry Potter jokes every time they meet.
Oh, man. So, the Southeast Division.
Yeah, where I usually start with these, and we can go through it either team by team or just kind of more broadly, who in this division do you think got better, and who in this division do you think got worse?
It's hard. I think the Wizards got better, but I'm not really sure. I don't think the Heat did any. I mean, the Heat did nothing, so they're the same. Charlotte probably got worse, although they're pretty depressing earlier. Orlando, you would think they got better, but every year we're saying, well, or this is a year Orlando finally turns into something. Never happens. And Atlanta probably is about the same. So I don't know if, you know, last year it went Miami, Washington, Charlotte, Orlando, Atlanta. Like, I could totally see it doing the same thing again this year.
Yeah, you know, I think that the only candidate for getting better is the Wizards, right? I mean, you could argue that Charlotte has been a little bit better than they've looked the last couple of years, and that they're kind of due to bounce back with good health. And you know, getting rid of Dwight could be a win for them. To me, I think the Wizards adding Dwight and giving him Gortat's role. Gortat did a lot of nice things for the Wizards over the last 4 or 5 years, but like toward the end, he just didn't have it athletically and was hurting them more than he was helping. And I think getting Dwight in there, even if he's kind of a net zero at the center position, will help them a lot. The Wizards' ceiling depends entirely on what version of John Wall they're going to get this year. The team I'm really curious about is Miami, because I feel like the last few years they've been very smart, and you know that they're going to show up and play their ass off and run good sets. And the question, though, is like how far that will take them, because the ceiling seems to be pretty clear. And I think at some point, like, they're going to kind of plateau and maybe take a step or two back. And those are the only two good teams in the division. So that's what we got.
I find Miami really depressing nowadays.
I do too. I like watching them. You know, I like a lot of their players. They just don't have any kind of star as the catalyst at the center of everything. Like, they want Josh Richardson to be that guy, but he's not going to turn into Kawhi, I don't think.
I find it depressing because this is Pat Riley's team. This is the anti-Riley. This is the anti-Heat that we've come to know and love, the big game hunting. And they've literally become, if you take away Miami from the start of their name and you put them in a small market team, they're totally forgettable. They're just that team that kind of, they're Charlotte, basically. I mean, maybe a little better, but that's what they are. That's the space they occupy in the league. They're a nice little team that wins 40-something games every year and loses in the first round of the playoffs, overachieves. You don't have anything bad to say about them. Great coaching. Players are fun to root for, but they just don't have it anymore, and there's no way for them to get any better, really. I just, for that to be Miami to me is like kind of depressing.
You know, I'm honestly, the one thing that I would love to read is like a long form report on what the hell happened two off seasons ago, where the Heat struck out on Hayward and then just decided it was time to like sink all their money into Olynyk and James Johnson and Deion Waiters. I mean, just because you're right. That's so out of character for Pat Riley, and the lack of foresight. I mean, maybe they just saw what Golden State was doing and said, look, we're going to be kind of spinning our wheels regardless for the next few years. Let's just go win 40 to 45 games and compete. But it's shocking that they decided that was the best path.
I don't have any particular inside information here, but my instinct is that a lot of it relates to Tyler Johnson. And so for those who remember what happened with Tyler Johnson's contract, which now can be fixed by the new CBA, but that was not under the previous one, was that if somebody signed one of those Jeremy Lin-style offer sheets, if a team matched it, they had to the contract had to follow the format that it was offered in. And so what that was mid-level, mid-level, max, max. And so what that meant was they had this kind of ticking time bomb in terms of cap space, that they had money in 17 that wasn't going to be there in 18. And so I think what happened was they just went, even though that was, I think that was about $15 million different between those two things, was that they just went, well, we're probably not going to have space to work with, so we might as well just go with what we know, with what we have. And they also had the strangest feel-good 500 season that I can ever remember, because of the whole, you know, I think it was 12 and 30, something like that?
11 and 30 and 30
yeah.
and 11.
11 and 30 and 30 and 11. So they walked out of that season going, oh my God, like, look at what we could be. And so just adding in some small pieces and bringing back, because that a lot of the story of that team is that they really, like, they bought in, they dug down, and they made a good story. And so you're sitting there going, well, if we could bring that back, add a little bit of talent, we can work with it. So it kind of all put it together, and it led to this kind of bizarre solution. And what I think is the story also with this division that is going to be a real challenge is that there wasn't a lot of personnel turnover. I mean, the Wizards had some, the Hawks had kind of a philosophical turnover to a point, like the Trae Young Schroeder thing. But really, I think what the story of this division in terms of improvement and not is health and aging. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are teams in this division that you hope that they might not be necessarily better, but maybe they can be healthier. And that's a possibility. And then there are other teams where maybe it goes the other way. Like Miami, I'm fascinated with them from this perspective because I would say most of their players, I mean, we'll see what Bam does this year. Most of their players are either prime or post-prime. So the passage of time doesn't necessarily help them a ton. We'll see if Tyler Johnson and Josh Richardson can do more. But really, Bam is the guy that I'm thinking, okay, he's definitely going to be better than he was last year. But then they have
Winslow.
Oh, and Winslow too. Yeah, he had a nice close to the year, and he's a good one for the health thing as well. And so then you have it. So like, okay, well then, how does that balance? You know, maybe hopefully they get more from Deion Waiters this year. We still don't know as we're recording this what's going to go on with D Wade. So you know, Miami, I could see them being similar, but maybe this is the year that Goran Dragic, you know, if he loses half a step, that would be a problem for this team because he has so much of an offensive role, especially depending on what happens with Wade. And I think that's the story with a lot of it. I mean, the Wizards, you brought up, like, what John Wall are we going to get? That's kind of health and age. You know, it's like, what's going on with his lower body? What does he have left? And those questions they're definitely less sexy, but they're incredibly important when you think about a division that is kind of in that precipice where guys might fall off or they might not.
Health, age, and attitude, I would say.
Yes. I would agree with that. Just real quick on Miami, your point on the cap space and the consequences of the Tyler Johnson deal, that is definitely what happened. And it's kind of interesting to think about because a similar thing happened with the Wizards
mm-hmm.
where they had one summer where they were going to have room and then extensions were going to kick in and they were going to have their hands tied. And I think that's been true for a number of teams around the league. And there are a handful of teams who have swung for the fences and connected, and it's been great. I think like Boston is a good example where like they were able to get Hayward, and that's like the window was open and they got Hayward and Horford, and it's been fantastic. But the Wizards and the Heat are kind of like how the other side lives, and the kind of the downside of that cap spike and the room that was created. And like when there's no good option, eventually the guy you're going to have to extend the guys you have, it gets tough. And for me, like, I just wonder why some of these teams, like, I understand they had space that they had to use, but like you had to be able to foresee the idea that like Waiters suddenly becomes kind of like unmovable at the number that he's on. And it's just, it's interesting how that affects the way we think of this team in general. Cause they do like, they go 10 deep with guys who are really interesting and kind of undervalued nationally, I guess, but are fun to watch. And I think in a different context, if they had a little bit more flexibility, they'd be more exciting to think about. Bam, I'm a big believer in Bam, and I would love to see him be able to kind of spread his wings this year. But that's another question Miami has to deal with is like how many minutes can you give him if Whiteside is there? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'm a little surprised Whiteside hasn't been traded yet. I guess this is the problem that they run into is nobody wants a guy like Hassan Whiteside on the team. $25 million a year.
Yeah, he's so expensive. So like maybe there are teams that would be interested in him in the abstract. Like let's say the amnesty provision still existed. I could see a team put together a meaningful bid on him. You know, like, hey, let's pay him $10 million a year. But it's really hard to make those kinds of trades work, especially when Miami would probably want to be losing salary in that deal. So like there are centers who make $20 million. million. There are centers who make lots of different kinds of bad money. But also, the other problem with Whiteside is that there are so many teams that are capped out at the same time that it makes it harder to do a deal. And, you know, these teams that are pushing up against CACs, like, theoretically, let's say the structure had been a little bit different and Miami was trying to stay below the tax and Washington had more wiggle room, I could have seen a Whiteside or Mahimi type of deal as possible.
I was
but
just gonna say.
With how the structure is now, the Wizards would never do that because it would just be so expensive that it wouldn't be worth it. It's better to get Dwight for the mid-level, even if you have to give him a player option in the second year. Both of them, actually. Whiteside has one, too.
Would you rather have Whiteside or Whiteside?
Mike, I can almost guarantee that when Danny was saying, like, who would want Whiteside, like, my mind immediately jumped to the Wizards, and that's really depressing, but, like, he does kind of have a Wizards vibe, like a desperation play at some point down the line. But, yeah, I mean, like, beyond that, it's hard. Like, there's not enough cap room around the league, and he's, like, such a distressed asset that I can't really imagine them finding a trade partner over the next year or two.
Well, what you mentioned about the cap space thing also applies to Charlotte and Orlando. I mean, they put a lot of eggs in 2016, and they have bad contracts on the books that are killing them. Charlotte had that great year in 2016 and then paid everybody, and voila, it turns out 120-something million to Nick Batum doesn't really age very well. Orlando paid all that money to Biyombo, and I don't even remember. Biyombo's on Charlotte, and Tim Mozgov is on Orlando now. That was one of the more hilarious trades of the past 2 years, whatever happened there. But I can understand it from the perspective of a Washington, a Charlotte, or a Orlando, because they're not a glamour market. Now, why Washington put all their eggs in the 2016 basket when they knew this, whole separate discussion. But the reason I find Miami depressing is that Miami's supposed to be the team that is the anti, like, sort of small market that knows they can't get the big name, so they're going to just try to be pretty good. And yet they've just tried to be pretty good. And it's just sort of sad to me how that's worked out.
It's also hard with Miami because it's going to be a couple of years until they really get out of this, and they're going to have to be really patient during that time. Because their stuff is going to clear out. I think it's in 2020. It should largely square up. So maybe there'll be a player then. But, I mean, the it'll be a holding pattern in all likelihood until that point. And you have to be really patient because, like, if you stretch us on Whiteside or something or whatever, if they end up doing some of those things, then that puts more money on future books. And Miami, it's so weird because I like a lot of their players and I like their team, but I also feel like I would enjoy a lot of their players more if they were on different teams, because the collective, like the blitzing that they do, is really, really fun. But, like, I think some of this is the split between offense and defense. Like Goran Dragic, I feel like I would enjoy him more with collaborative talent and a system that allowed him to sing more. I really loved watching him play with Slovenia during Eurobasket. I think that was last summer. And, you know, he's getting more of a chance with when Wade isn't there. You know, we'll see if Wade comes back. But a lot of these guys, just because they're on the same team, they play fewer minutes and all that, I think that helps their intensity. But I feel like I know what they are at this point, and so you don't have the discovery, which is sometimes the most fun thing about watching the NBA.
This is the thing I really struggle with them. I mean, I really like Winslow as a player, but, I mean, at a certain point, you can't have Winslow and Richardson and Rodney Magruder and James Johnson and Olynyk and give him two positions. You know, it's... you got to make some choices there. And if Winslow, it seemed like he made some strides with this 3-point shot, but I always feel like 3-point percentage can be a little misleading. What really matters is, do people care about you at the 3-point line? Do you have a quick release? Are you a threat out there? And I just don't know if he is. So if he's mostly playing the 4, is Josh Richardson a 2? And if that's the case, does that mean guys like Wayne Ellington, who had another terrific year, Johnson, who still is there, Waiters, and maybe Wade, do they get bumped from the best 5? I just don't know what their best 5 is. I think it's kind of, in a way, it's sort of nice to be able to have this Swiss Army knife of, you know, we don't know exactly what we can close with whoever we want. But I think you do run into some problems when you have Whiteside on the team, when you have young players you're trying to develop for the next era of Heat basketball, the post-2020 era, the Richardsons and the Winslows and the Adebayos. And you still have a lot of these other guys. It's sort of like you have two different problems. So I'm really curious what their best 5 is.
Yeah, well, all I can say is that thinking through the options for their best 5, like who you're closing with in the playoffs, just became like pretty sobering, because again, I love watching this team every night. But yeah, that's the issue, is that a lot of these guys are fun to watch in the third quarter, but not necessarily people you want to be counting on to close big games. Like I love Wayne Ellington, but and he might be in their best five if you're looking for someone who can help them kind of stretch the floor and open things up for Dragic. Like I probably prefer running Wayne Ellington off screens than like letting Dwayne Wade ISO for 15 seconds at the top of the key. But it's like there's not many like great options either way.
If you could do line changes like in hockey, they would be so good. Like if you can make a sub after each possession, so you have your offense five and your defense five. But as is, you saw it in the playoffs. I mean, Philly's just a team that's that long and athletic. Like, you just can't create any good offense. Even if those guys shoot decent percentages in the regular season, they're not threats. They can be taken away, and that's the problem.
Yeah, and that gets the trade-off here. So you bring there are a lot of guys on Miami that you can bring up, and I'm happy Mike mentioned Justice Winslow. I would also mention Brandon Ingram here, where the way that I like to think about the credibility of a guy as a shooter is imagining defending them within a team concept. And so you're sitting there going, how willing would I be to stray off them? How willing would I be to help off them? And so these guys that shoot a high percentage but on a really low volume, I think you're pretty comfortable helping off them. But there are players who, sometimes it's a lagging indicator, sometimes it's not, who you just aren't as comfortable with that. And that's really where the value of a shooter comes. Even like Ryan Anderson's a good example of this, where even if he ends up not taking many shots in that specific game, his guy isn't going to go too far off him, because he knows if he does, then that shot is there. Whereas with Justice Winslow, I don't think anybody's freaking out. Okay, Justice Winslow's in the corner. Yeah, maybe he'll take some threes. Maybe he'll make some threes. He has had some really good nights. But for me, until you reach that point, bringing more volume, or you're just ludicrously successful, I don't think you're that much of a threat. I don't think you're affecting the decision-making process as much.
The speed of the release matters, too. I mean, Winslow release is like a trebuchet.
In the playoffs. It is trebuchet. Yeah, I mean, you saw it in the playoffs. He was pretty much like left out on an island by the Sixers. But yeah.
There is
like
value in having a good-looking shot. Aesthetics matter. You know, if you look like you're a shooter, you'll be defended like you look like a shooter. Did you guys watch the WNBA stuff? Seattle had this. Did you watch the WNBA finals? I think this is like the most recent.
I watched Seattle
has this one player who is really awesome, but they would always leave her open because her shot was slow and ugly. It went in decent amount of the time, and it obviously worked, but it's just the fact that the shot doesn't look good that makes people leave you. You know, even if it's successful.
And the flip side of that, I would say, like a great example in the Ryan Anderson mold, and to pivot to another Southeast team, is Bradley Beal has never been quite as good a shooter as people think he is, but he just looks like his stroke is so pure and he looks so good taking the jumpers that everyone guards him as if he's Klay Thompson from three, when really, like, he just has never quite taken that next step to become a knockdown shooter that way. But he creates a lot, he has a lot of gravity because teams give him a lot of respect.
And by contrast, Otto Porter's shot looks a little weird, but it goes in a lot more often. And so he's not as respected as much, even though he's a way better spot-up shooter in terms of percentage.
So a couple of the health things to talk about with this division. So like with Washington, John Wall only played in 41 games last year. They did far better during the time that he was out than I anticipated. But everybody else stayed pretty healthy. I mean, I as far as I can recall, the rest of the team stayed pretty healthy. They did lose Mike Scott and a few other pieces. So that could square either way. I mean, what John Wall do we see? How much time do any of these guys miss? And another one like that, which I think is a really fascinating one, is Charlotte. Kemba Walker played 80 games, played a lot of time. And I believe one of the two games he missed was after their season was over. But then Cody Zeller only played in 33. He got marginalized by Dwight Howard. My personal belief is that Cody Zeller and Dwight Howard, they're very different players, but I think they're similar like caliber players. And so maybe having Cody Zeller is going to help. Granted, his backup is now Bismack Biyombo, who is substantially worse. But with those two teams, like, I could see making an argument either way. Like, I think they're key players that could be healthier, but you have so many other potential problem areas areas that could manifest themselves.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that on the Washington side, the one thing that I would add is that, and it's funny, things got so bad toward the end of the year. I remember I DM'd Prada to complain and just sort of vent for about a couple minutes about the Wizards continuing to play Otto Porter, even though he was like visibly injured and had been for 3 or 4 months. That's one thing that like wasn't really reported nationally. Halfway through the Raptors series, they finally shut him down because I believe he had like a blood clot issue and there was a risk of serious complications, but he was playing hurt for basically the entire second half of the season. And if you go back and look at his numbers from the first 2 months compared with what he was doing toward the end of the year, like there's actually a pretty big difference. So to me, one of the reasons I'm bullish on the Wiz this year is that I think they're going to get back Wall at, I mean, I actually don't see Wall getting back to where he was 2 years ago at an all NBA level, but I think he's going to be like 80 to 90% of that, which is still a very good player and an all-star. But I also think they're going to get back like the best version of Otto Porter, who still is probably undervalued nationally.
To me, the question is, I think I agree with that. And also, I mean, while in the 41 games he played, there were a few there where he was like just dragging his leg, just sitting on the wing doing nothing. And he may as well have been hurt. Although I would argue that, I mean, I don't know. I feel like a lot of it will depend on how he comes into camp. Like, I think he sort of wasn't in as good condition as he was the year when he had just such an amazing year in 2017. And I think that put him a little behind the eight ball. You also remember, too, that Markieff Morris was hurt to start the year. And I don't think he really got back to his full potential for a while and maybe even all a year. So there was that. The thing I worry about with them remains, you know, okay, so ingredients-wise, this all makes a lot of sense. You know, you've got Otto is underrated. Beal proved he can play with or without the ball. I know his efficiency numbers suffered, but again, the threat level I think remains. Wall will probably be healthier. Morris should be healthier. Gortat was definitely a shell of himself. Jeff Green had a decent year last year. Rivers helps them with depth. Satoransky emerged. Kelly Oubre should be better. But are they going to play the right players at the right times? I think is really the question I have with these guys. Like, this comes down a little bit to Scott Brooks, but I also just worry that I think their best lineup is when they play Otto Porter at power forward. But for that to happen, I don't think Scott Brooks has always fully embraced that. And for that to happen really well, one of Satoransky or Oubre has got to improve as a shooter. Otherwise, they're going to lose minutes to Austin Rivers. And all the other things they do will sort of be underrated. So I'm a little worried about who plays when and like how often is Dwight really going to play. Like, is he okay not playing in crunch time a lot of this time? Is he fine being a minute soaker? Does he want to be something more? I think there are a lot of real playing time questions with them.
Yeah, Danny, what are your impressions of the Wizards from the West Coast and particularly Scott Brooks, actually, because Mike and I are probably too deep in the weeds, but from an outsider's perspective, someone who probably watches a handful of Wiz games, but not every game, what do you think of Brooks?
I've been surprised that some of the elements I expected to be a part of his MO, like, I mean, those OKC teams always defended, even when they were young, and so I thought that was going to transfer over a lot more cleanly than it has. And, you know, sometimes that is just personnel, but I mean, maybe it's the Wizards got older and all that kind of stuff, they didn't have as much to prove, because they defended decently well, and they defended well in the early, I think it was the early Whitman years, it might have been the mid-Whitman years, either way. But the biggest frustration with Scott Brooks, and this is not a new frustration for me with Scott Brooks, is that idea of, is he willing to play the best guys even if it leads to unconventional lineups? Because going smaller, they actually are one of the few teams in the league, even if their wings are imperfect, that has enough forward-sized guys to throw some of these things out there. And especially last year, Gortat was not so good that you have to play him. It wasn't one of those circumstances where you have to play a center because he's one of your best players or anything like that. So yeah, more Oubre, more Porter at the four, and it basically, and then the other part of that is it took, effectively, you could call it an act of God for him to actually try Satoransky at the one, and it worked. Like, basically, Scott Brooks...
And then Ty Lawson took his minutes!
Yes, and then Ty Lawson took his minutes. That's one of my big frustrations with Scott Brooks going back to when he was in OKC, is that he has his preferences, and the only way to change that is basically to take pieces off the board. And
yes,
that can happen. You know, that can happen via trade, that can happen via signing, but I don't trust Grunfeld to do that, so that's a problem as well. And
I was gonna say, they added pieces to the board. They gave him Austin Rivers, and they gave him Jeff Green.
Mm-hmm. But I could actually...
Oh, God, I forgot about Jeff Green. Oh, my God. That's really tough.
So, yeah, that's something I wanted to talk actually with you guys, to turn it back with you, is... Brooks has more quality players now, I think. Well, I mean, we'll see with, I think Jeff Green's going to be worse than Mike Scott was last year. I think Scott had a nice year. But adding in Austin Rivers, Dwight for Gortat, I would say is an upgrade based on what Gortat was last year. But it's more of a reshuffling than anything else. And so, like, do you feel confident that Scott Brooks, confident, not confident, whatever, either that they start or finish with the deck in the right order?
Well, I'll start there. I'm glad you confirmed a lot of my own frustrations with Brooks, or validated my frustrations with Brooks, because, yeah, that's my worry, even with Dwight. I mean, I hadn't thought to be worried about playing Jeff Green too many minutes, but I probably should be also. But, like, even with Dwight, who the Wizards are thinking of as a former MVP candidate, likely Hall of Famer, great player, who's going to kind of raise both the floor and the ceiling for them this year. I think some of that's true, but I also think, like, everyone should be very clear-eyed about who should be playing at the end of games. And if there's if Markieff Morris is playing his best game, like, you should be closing with that lineup, with him at the five and Otto at the four. And Satoransky as a backup guard is really valuable in ways that I don't know. And it's not just the Wizards, it's not just Brooks and Grunfeld, but I think a lot of the NBA still doesn't appreciate the value of a point guard who can kind of move off the ball and sort of force people to guard five positions, because a lot of guards can't do that. But Satoransky can, and he can be a threat. And that, I think, creates a lot of opportunities for everyone else. And I, to be honest with you, I don't think Brooks understands that or values different qualities more, I would say. I'm sure he understands just fine. But so that's a worry for sure.
No, if they got weird, I think they'd be more fun and more interesting. And I think they have to get weird to really compete. But I don't know if they have the people to get weird. You know, all this said, though, I mean, the season will come down to two players. It'll come down to Wall, and it'll come down to Morris. If those two guys were really locked in 2 years ago and they had a great season, those two guys were not at all locked in for different reasons last year, and they had a poor season. Wall is the star player, is the one that dictates everything and dictates the mood of the team, and Morris is sort of the barometer and the heartbeat of the team. That's all all this stuff about Brooks and lineups and all this stuff. I mean, if Wall and Morris play well, they're going to be good. If Wall and Morris are not at their as good as they can be, they're not going to be as good.
I agree with that completely.
What it comes down to.
Plenty more to talk about with Mike and Andrew, but want to take a quick moment to tell you about BetOnline. Football season is here. Don't need to worry about waiting for college football, for the NFL, both. It's a great time to watch those sports, and one way to certainly make it more interesting is through betonline.ag. You can check it out, and they have a 50% sign-up bonus if you use the promo code PODCAST1. That's PODCAST and then the number one, which also tells them, of course, that you came from us. And the Podcast One Sportsnet, we're doing a prediction challenge this year. As a non-football person, it would be, I mean, I still watch it, but it's not my field of work at this point. Hoping to do better in it than I did week one. Still a little bit bitter about the Steelers-Browns tie, but I mean, it is what it is. But you can check that out as well. It's a fun thing that we're doing. You can go to Podcast One Sportsnet's website, and it should be pretty much on the front page. They have rankings and all that fun stuff. A lot of the podcast hosts are checking that out as well. But the most important thing you can do, absolutely, is to check out betonline.ag. tons of different options depending on what you're into. And of course, if you're a baseball fan or anything else that is still going on, you can check it out as well. And if you do so, use the promo code PODCAST1, PODCAST, then the number one. Tells them you came from us, and then you get that 50% sign-up bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. I also want to tell you about Pluto TV. And Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. And you heard me right, that's free streaming. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. They never even ask you for a credit card. Don't have to sign up. It's a really cool idea. I checked out their PC interface. You can do it on a variety of devices, your phone, Roku, smart TVs, PlayStations, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, whatever really you're looking for. You can check it out there. You don't have to ever pay for TV again. In its easy, completely legal way to watch your favorite television shows and hit movies. So you should definitely check it out. Pluto TV in basically whatever device you're interested in. I said I mentioned it in PC, but you can really go all over the board with it. Check it out. Transition to the next question, and that's a move, a pick, a trade, a signing that stood out. And I want to start with the two moves, the two biggest things that the Hawks did. I think that, like, if we're playing the long game with the Southeast Division, I think that the story of 2018 eventually will be the Hawks. And so one part of that, the first part, was the decision to move down two picks in the draft, pick up a first-round pick that is lightly protected. Well, I expect they'll get it this year from the Dallas Mavericks to basically to take Trae Young. And that's a really interesting bet on your board. It's the same description I used back when Danny Ainge did that and worked out pretty well for Boston when he did so far. And then, so that's one big move. And then the other one was the Oklahoma City trade. And so basically, the easiest way to think about that trade from their perspective was that they took on Carmelo Anthony's expensive expiring contract, bought him out, and offloaded Dennis Schroeder. And I am a far bigger fan of the latter move than the former move, but I think both are very, very important.
Yeah. Can I just say, I love the former move just as much. And I am wary of comparing it to what the Celtics did, because that felt like lightning in a bottle. And it's unlikely that teams are going to catch that 2 years in a row. And somehow Danny Ainge just continues to straight gold out of nowhere, and we all just are watching it happen. But I do think I like the guts it takes to say, you know what, we think Trae Young is going to be better than Luka Doncic or just as good. We don't think Luka Doncic is going to be a superstar. So let's flip this pick and go and pick up another likely top 10 pick and take another guy who we think has a lot of upside. And to me, I think Trae Young's upside, it may be less realistic that he gets there than someone like Doncic, but his upside is just as high, if not higher, than what Doncic is going to be in Dallas. You look at even within this division, I would much rather be a Hawks fan right now, given the possibilities that have opened up over the last year, and particularly given the trade in June, than I would be. Like, I wouldn't want to be a Magic fan. You know, like, there's the future is kind of dark and murky for them, but the Hawks are going to have some lottery tickets, and I think that's exciting.
I don't really know, like, how Young versus Doncic is going to work out. I don't think I've watched them enough. The thing that I find more interesting is that they're even in a position to play the long game. I mean, this is not a franchise that has ever done this before. This is a franchise that's always had a, you know, we got to put butts in the seats and be short-term thinking sort of mode. So I'm very curious what changed, because, yeah, these are moves for 2023. You know, they're not doing the process, but they are going long down the road, and they don't care about winning for a long time. I know Travis Schlenk is very well regarded, and I know that he was part of Golden State, but I must admit that I'm a little surprised, and I'm very curious to see how much rope he gets if this doesn't start off well. Because in a vacuum, I think you've made the upside of the team much stronger. And I think if you let it all play out to fruition, you could be way better with a way higher ceiling. But it's very un-Hawks-like, very much unlike what happens in that market. They're not going to draw well for a couple years. You know, they're going to have some real rough times. Last year was sort of year zero, and now you've pushed the timetable back even more. How much patience are they really going to have to see this through? Because if they don't have the patience to see this through in the end, then I think the trades they made are a big mistake. You have to follow it up by, like, following through the plan. And I'm very curious to see if they do.
Yeah, to me, I think the Doncic deal comes down to them not thinking that he's going to be a star, which, you know, it just depends on how excited you are about Doncic and what you see for him over the next 5 to 10 years. And I'm not a big Doncic guy, but again, like, we're pretty much all guessing here. I just admire them kind of doubling down on their evaluation of him.
It's interesting how many teams said no to Doncic. For all the stuff we love, people love about him, it is interesting that the Hawks were not, they did it most emphatically, but there were two other teams that passed on him, and there was a couple others that didn't try to move up as vigorously as we probably thought they should have.
Well, can I make a point on that, though?
Wrong?
The team that moved up,
go for it.
The team that moved up was Dallas. The teams that passed on him were Phoenix and Sacramento, and to an extent Atlanta. If I were to pick the best front office of those four teams, I would say it's Dallas. If I were to pick the worst of those front offices, it would be Sacramento. So
I mean, that might be it. I mean, it totally could be that. It also, I mean, there were reports that Cleveland balked at the idea of taking on Kent Bazemore to move up. I'm not sure that's a great front office either, but, you know, they might all be wrong. I don't know. I just think if it was just one of them, I'd feel a lot better.
Sure.
Well, and you know what? I may be too, like, galaxy brain here, but I think that people are reading too much into the, like, rampant dysfunction in, like, actually, Phoenix and Sacramento are pretty rough.
I was going to say.
but I think the way people processed those moves, the Doncic trade basically, was to say everyone is an idiot, anyone who can't see this guy's potential as a superstar for the next 10 years is an idiot. And they were kind of talked about in these, like, xenophobic terms as if they were kind of living in the dark ages when, you know, that might be true in one or two places. But I talked to a number of scouts who were just like, look, Doncic is going to be very good. He's going to be kind of a rich man's Joe Ingles, a, like, half Joe Johnson, half Hedo Turkoglu, like, but he's not going to be the player that the internet thinks he's going to be. And so there are a lot of smart people who feel that way, and it didn't play as well to say that on Twitter, but it's a real possibility.
Man, rich man's Joe Ingles.
Joe Ingles is great, and a rich man's Joe Ingles is really good. So it's he's bad.
Well, so what this relates to for me is this dichotomy between what Luka Doncic did and what he might be. I mean, he is pretty unequivocally the most accomplished European teenage basketball player ever. But accomplished does not necessarily mean he's going to be a great NBA player. And so
he is just as young. He's the same age as these college players. So that's where I raise my eyebrows a little bit. I mean, I actually don't know. I'm just...
Yeah, but I mean,
put it this way. It seems too convenient that it's just something like xenophobia.
Right, it is. And no. And so that's the thing. For me, like, so I had Doncic number one on my board, but I didn't think he was this unquestionable game changer or anything like that. The reason I had him number one was more because I didn't love anybody else. And so that's why I kind of ended up in this weird middle ground where it's like, I like him more than the people who are down on Doncic, but I do not like him as much as the people who think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, because the challenge with players who are creators, and that's exactly what Luka Doncic was drafted to do, is that they have to be able to generate separation. And I think he can do everything else, but like that's what part of what makes Ben Simmons special. Ben Simmons, big dude, but he creates separation. He's more athletic, has a really good handle compared to the guys who are guarding him. Like, that's just what Ben Simmons can do. Not every player who is 6'8" or taller, 6'6", whatever they're going to be, that can pass, can get by their guy. And so if he can't do that regularly, then Doncic is a useful piece. Then you get into the high-end Joe Ingles type thing, where Joe Ingles is a nice player, you're really happy that he's on your team, but you're going to need somebody else to run the show, and then you're starting to talk about, well, he's a good complementary playmaker, if he can catch and shoot, all that kind of stuff. But that is, you know, then you're talking more like you're talking about a support player, and support players just aren't nearly valuable.
I agree with that, and I think it's very perceptive, and that's kind of the case against worshiping the Mavs for trading up for him. Like what they did was a gamble, and it made sense for them, and they do have a smart front office, but I also feel like they've had a desperate front office for the last few years, and they've swung and missed on a number of other options that would have allowed them to contend, and so trading up for Doncic wound up being the best thing for them. But the thing you mentioned was one of the things that drove me crazy. The idea, like, every time someone would make the case for Doncic, they would say he's the most accomplished player in the second best league in the world, which is true. However, college is not that far behind the EuroLeague in certain respects, and particularly with respect to athleticism. I would say college, in certain areas of college and the elite programs, like, you're going to see much better athleticism and more tests for guys than you will in EuroLeague. And like, the whole question with Doncic is going to be whether he's able to succeed against NBA athletes who are going to be up in his grill the entire time. And like, it's fair to kind of say, let's wait and see, because that's one where like we don't really know. And there just weren't as many tests in the league that he was in.
Here's a question. How many members of the Hawks' current roster will be on the team when they make the playoffs for the first time?
That's a good question.
I think it's a legit. I'm like, legitimately curious as far as the timeline here, because a couple of those guys that are not Trae Young are going to be up for extensions before then. So
My instinct is probably like four, and almost all those guys are on rookie scale contracts, you know, so like Trae Young, either Herder, Spellman, or both, John Collins, that type of conversation. No, I don't think Lynn, I don't think Dwayne Dedman, Muscala is already gone because he was included in the trade and in the Schroeder trade. And then, I don't think it's going to be many, because I think the Hawks are also a long way off. And there's also a fundamental difference with this in the process, because Philly had so many bites at the apple. And so maybe Atlanta gets there, they're bad for another couple of years. And they didn't hit on all of them. I mean, Jahlil Okafor ended up missing out. Nerlens, you know, like, Embiid ended up much better.
Markel Fultz. What?
Yeah, we'll see what happens with Markel Fultz. But the hits they got, I mean, so Trae Young, he's going to be a lightning rod for a long time, because the ceiling on him is insane. If he can be...
Is it?
Yes. The ceiling on him is a top five offensive player in the league.
Wow. I don't know. I love Trae Young. I agree with you, though, that the ceiling on him, to me, is like a slightly better version of Damian Lillard. And Damian Lillard probably isn't a top five offensive player, but I would say he's top 10. And Trae Young is going to be... he has the chance to be Damian Lillard, but as a much better passer who kind of opens up the floor for everybody. And that, I think, is like crazy valuable and would be a lot of fun to watch as just from a league standpoint. It would be great to have a player like that as kind of like a new age Steve Nash. And there's also a chance that like his teammates attack him after like the fourth missed 35 footer next year, and like it gets very dark, so like who knows what happens with Trae Young.
Go ahead.
Lillard is really damn good. I feel like that's asking a lot of him to get to that level. I don't know if he can do that.
And circling back on what I talked about with Luka, is that Trae Young is also not great at creating separation unless his shot is so good that people are freaking out. Like, he requires a lot of screeners. He requires a lot of defensive attention due to his shot. But it's kind of like the idea that the theory of him, because also Young will be hopefully coming of age at a time that the NBA is more accustomed to using what he does. Like, Lillard, I feel like there is more that he could do not that Terry Stotts is doing a bad job, but just because there isn't as much envelope pushing necessarily in Portland's offense. And Lillard's great, and his athleticism, I think, is a massive difference between him and Trae Young.
What more envelope pushing can be done? Like, are we talking, like, shooting literal 40-footers? Like, I think using
Dame, giving him more activity off ball and just basically forcing. So something I don't.
Don't
see
they do that with their flow offense?
They do some of it, but I think they could do more. And I don't. It feels like there are approaches of just like starting stuff higher out on the court and using. Also, because they generally don't have as much spacing, depending on who they have at the four, that sometimes they get into issues where he drives into a thicket. I mean, Dame is unbelievable at finishing in traffic. But I think that there's more with pick and pops and more. There are some wrinkles that it's not like Terry Stotts is an unbelievable coach. He's one of my favorites in the league. But it's a lot of it, I think, is more their personnel. And just, yeah, I mean, shooting, not necessarily shooting 40-footers, but having defenders feel like, oh, crap, you're at 30 to 35 feet. I have to be close to you. Like, that can open up a lot. Because remember, Portland has a second ball handler on this team. I think there is more that they can do. Like, I feel the thing for me with this is, I don't feel that I'm thinking big enough. Maybe it's watching D'Antoni teams and everything else, but it's like, I feel like there are things that 5 to 10 years from now that we will just be like, well, why wasn't that here 20 years ago?
And I totally agree with that.
And the that Lillard is a guy who can do all of that.
Is the question to me, as it goes back to Trae Young, is are those things going to be beneficial for Trae Young, or have we explored the optimal amount of space for the Trae Young style player in the NBA at this point, and we're going to go a different way? I think that's the bet. The bet that the Hawks are making is that there is more room to grow for that type of player versus a Luka Doncic type of player. And I actually don't know, but it seems to me like we spent the last 5 years pushing the boundaries for the Trae Young type of players. Like, are we now saying that there's 5 more years of boundaries to push? Like, that to me seems hard to believe, but it's possible, and that's why I worry a little bit about him. I could totally see him not being the best player in that team if they're going to go where they want to go.
Yeah, I think that's a fair concern, and Danny is dead on. Like, I think the thing that Trae Young does really well is pass in tight spaces. The issue is that he's not going to be able to create very much space getting into the lane even and getting by people and sort of being able to open up the defense if he can't shoot. So while I guess it's kind of a paradox where I think he's going to have equal value as a passer, but the passing only becomes a real threat that puts pressure on defenses if the jumper is a threat. And so with Trae, for 2 or 3 months last year, he looked like a great shooter. And then the jumper kind of tailed off, and there was a lot of volume, and he was asked to do a lot at Oklahoma. And it's hard to know what a realistic number is going to be for him as a three-point shooter in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I want to be unambiguous about this. Trae Young's floor is incredibly low, like uncomfortably low for most players taken as high as he was. Like, backup guard, I could totally...
Like DJ Augustine, are you saying?
I think he could be, if his shot doesn't come around, he could be lower than that, because his defense was atrocious in college. And
yeah,
from what I recall hearing about from him in high school, it wasn't any better then. And, you know, and he doesn't create a ton of separation. So, like, if the shot isn't falling, if a team doesn't really know how to utilize him... I mean, he always has value as an off-ball guy, because I think his catch-and-shoot mechanics are also still very, very good. But yeah, he could be a backup guard. Like, absolutely, like, it would not surprise me in the least if Trae Young is not a starter in the league. So that's what you have to reconcile with him. Is it's like, well, is the juice worth the squeeze? And that's part of the reason why he fell and could have fallen a lot further. I mean, that was something that didn't end up happening with these guys. But I mean, there was a possibility. I mean, if people remember early on draft night that he might fall to like 10. Like, that was it ended up not happening, but it could have.
Well. And what I would add is that's one of the reasons I'm excited to watch him, because there is just like a wide spectrum of outcomes for him as an NBA player, or maybe narrow, and it's either he's going to be very good and one of the most exciting players in the league, or he's going to be pretty rough and is going to have kind of a rough road after the next couple of years. But the other thing is, and to circle back to something Mike said like 15 minutes ago, I'm putting a lot of faith in the Hawks front office and trusting the idea that this was a bet on their big board and the way they evaluated everybody. But there's also a chance, and there was talk around the draft, that like the Hawks owners wanted Trae Young over Luka Doncic because they thought Trae Young was going to be able to sell tickets. And there was a push to sort of like bring him in as the new Steph Curry and like the star that's going to kind of like make the Hawks an attraction. And if that,
boy, that's funny,
if that's the thinking, like that's not great.
Well, it's also funny because I feel like Luka Doncic would sell more tickets, but alas.
Yeah.
Well, Trae Young is definitely more famous.
NBA Twitter.
Well, and I'll bring up a brief point there. Not that it's necessarily appropriate here. I've been thinking about this recently. College stars who aren't good NBA players do not sell tickets. Like, that's just, it's so
right.
funny how
bad
teams,
NBA players don't sell tickets.
Right. Like, Jimmer Fredette was super famous in college. Like, and even the guys in college who end up becoming pros that sell tickets aren't that way because of college. Like, Carmelo Anthony does not sell tickets, maybe other than to Syracuse alums, to people because of what he did in college. No, he was and is a successful professional basketball player. And it is so ludicrous to me that there are still teams and front offices that consider that, because it, you know, like the ultimate probably example of this is Giannis. Like, Giannis did sell tickets at any level before he was a professional, and now he sells tickets all over the country. And that's
now
just,
the Bucks have a whole new stadium because of Giannis, you know?
It's appalling to me that stuff still happens. It's whether the guy is a good player or not, especially because in the NBA, even the guys who it's maybe not the most telegenic style of play, but if the team wins, people want to see winning teams. You know, like, and maybe there's a line here incidentally involving somebody like Miami, where there are teams that win that aren't fun to watch, and there are teams that are bad that are. But generally speaking, generally speaking, teams that win do well in attendance and teams that lose do not. And, you know, if
the owner's got to look at the balance sheet every year, and we don't have to do that. So
that's very true. And I would love to get the numbers on jersey sales and just like what teams bring in on that. Cause I don't know, there is a possibility. I don't know that the revenue side, like the non-ticket sale revenue, that stuff that is very rarely made public, that affects it. But I think a lot of that stuff gets shared. So I don't think that's as much for the team.
No. Anyone who's worked for a media company knows that there's always pressure from up high to do things that don't make sense to anyone down low at any
media company.
So it's the same thing here.
Well, I'll leave that there, but I want to take a quick moment to tell you about TrueCar. These days, news travels lightning fast, which is great if you're a sports fan. Between status updates, breaking news notifications, and Twitter feeds, you can always be up to the minute on every team and every game. While this is great for sports, it is the opposite when it comes to buying a car. Go online and you are bombarded with numbers. Invoice, list price, dealer price. It is hard to know how to recognize a good price. Not anymore. Introducing True Price from TrueCar. It is the only price you need to know because it is exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories. How do you know if your True Price is a great price? Because TrueCar shows you what other people paid for that same car you want, so you know how to recognize a good price. And your certified dealers know this, so they set their True Price competitively so they can win your business. So, when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
How good are the Magic? Like, I gotta say, like, I looked at their team today and see Aaron Gordon, who had a good year until he started to get hurt. I see Isaac is really interesting and was hurt a lot of last year, and you didn't get it from him. Mo Bamba seems very intriguing. I don't know who the hell is playing point guard, but, you know, they still have Fournier. And they now have a coach that's, like, very much a, like, guy you bring in when it's, like, we're going to have to – are you guys soccer fans?
A little bit.
So he's sort of like the coach that you bring in when you're in a relegation battle and just gets you to act professional. Like that's what Steve Clifford is. Like, he's going to get them to a base level of competence that other coaches weren't. So I kind of think that this might be a better than expected year for them. But I've also said that like the last 3 years, so I could be wrong.
Well, I was going to say that's sort of what Frank Vogel was supposed to be too when they brought him in 2 years ago. I, you know, the Magic, it's tough, and this is why when Danny told me we were doing the Southeast, I was like, I don't know what to say about the Magic. Like, I avoid watching their games. I don't like, I mean, I like all their guys individually, but like, I would love to take Aaron Gordon. I wish he had signed with the Pacers this offseason. I'd love to see him in a different situation where he wasn't asked to be more than he actually is. Like, I think as a third or fourth guy on a good team, as like kind of a Swiss Army knife, like, he could be a lot of fun, but watching him strain to be the lead superstar has really been pretty brutal. And I'm glad he got paid, but like, I'm not looking forward to more of that. I kind of hoped that that had run its course. And like, Isaac, I really like, but now I like Isaac as a five. Now he's got to be kind of wedged between Aaron Gordon at the three and Mo Bamba as a five. And like, that's not a great idea, and everybody can see it, and it's just going to happen anyways. That's, I feel like we've been having the same conversation with the Magic for a couple years now.
I mean, we have.
Yeah, we have.
I would say with Gordon, by the way, I think the force angle is sort of the wrong way. Like, I would love to have seen him forced to be a Swiss Army knife. I think he yearns to be a more featured player than his skills suggest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the other way. I would love to have seen him get a little uncomfortable and have to play winning for a winning team.
Yeah, I would much prefer to see him as a small fish in a big pond than a big fish in a small pond. I think that would fit his game well. I mean, there was a lot of like weird stuff with what he did last year. Two big points on the Magic. One is, if they had point guards, I would feel so much more confident about this team. Like, they have some defensive identity stuff that I really like. I mean, you even saw it in Summer League. There were some moments where they had Isaac and Bamba together at the four and the five, and teams just couldn't do anything inside 12 feet. And that was really exciting. And granted, NBA players are a whole lot better than Summer League players, but there are some elements of that that could be true. But without a point guard, that does two things. One is, it makes their offense worse, but also that can sabotage their defense, because you get a smaller proportion of your possessions in the half court, and you just have to deal with these teams. And I don't think they have guys to defend well in transition. But the second part, and I think this is actually the more intriguing thing for somebody like me who enjoys the like process of discovery, is Steve Clifford signed up for a team that has dramatically different personnel than what he had in Charlotte. And so we're going to get a really good sense of what is a Steve Clifford team, because like, a lot of the center specific stuff that they did, you know, it was these, they relied a lot on these less mobile guys, more the stout, you know, and they were able to build good defenses around Al Jefferson and a lot of these things. And then offensively, to me, I never really saw too much Magic from Clifford. I hate that I just used that word, but they did too much of that, but they had Kemba freaking Walker, and so they made a lot of that work. So now he has intriguing defensive personnel that's more on the mobility side than the stability side, and then they're going to have to figure out how to cobble together this offense. And so I have absolutely no idea what we're going to see. Like, what elements of it? Is this another low turnover, strong rebounding team? Well, maybe, but they don't have the personnel for that.
I probably will be.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and the one thing I would piggyback on Danny to say that I think if Jonathan Isaac, I watched a little bit of him in Summer League, and I heard good things from people who watch more. If he can be fluid enough to operate on the perimeter and hit from out there and kind of be like a real four and not just a big guy who's been kind of shoehorned into an awkward perimeter role, like, if he can really inhabit that role and thrive, then pairing him with Bamba gets pretty interesting and could be a lot of fun going forward. I'm just a little skeptical of it, given what I saw of him at FSU. And I mean, we didn't see much of him last year, but like, I don't know if that's really his destiny, but it would be fun.
Yeah. My guess is offensively, we're going to see a lot of Evan Fournier pin downs and single double action and a good deal of sort of these. You'll have like five scripted plays for Aaron Gordon, and you'll probably post up Nick Vucevic a lot, and it'll be pretty vanilla, but it'll be pretty back to basics. And then defensively, I think you're right. It does come down to whether Isaac can really play the four position. But I suspect like it's going to be a lot of structure, not a lot of turnovers, but not a lot of dynamism. They'll be like 22nd in offense, and upside is they'll be 10th in defense, and they'll win in the mid-30s, high 30s, low 40s. Like, I think it will look a lot like the Steve Clifford teams we know, even though the personnel is different. Like, he just strikes me as that's why you bring a Steve Clifford in.
Do you really think high 30s, low 40s for them?
I mean, I could see it. I mean,
I think that's more your best case, right? That's not what you're expecting, not to speak for you.
I mean, no, but, like, the East beyond, you know, Washington, Miami is just, I mean, who do you think is going to have a better record, Charlotte or Orlando? I mean, I think there's quite an easy world where the answer is Orlando, especially if Kemba is traded and Batum gets hurt again and the Hornets depth stinks. And, you know, Detroit is sort of a bit of a combustible team. Like, they could be really good or they could be a huge question mark. You know, they're in the mix. And then other than those two teams, I mean, where are you looking for potential sort of teams that sneak into the playoff race?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you see from Cleveland and a couple of these other teams. And, I mean, Brooklyn is maybe in the conversation, but I think of them as a team that tops out before the playoff race. You know, like, maybe they could be in the high 30s, but that's probably not going to be enough to get in.
Yeah, to me, I think Miami and Detroit are going to be the final two playoff teams. I guess Charlotte, like, if things go really well, they could be in that mix also. Brooklyn, I'm still holding on to my D'Angelo Russell stock. I'm probably the only one in America who still believes in him. But objectively speaking, it's hard to imagine they go very far if things are still kind of revolving around him.
And well, so here's the thing, though. D'Angelo Russell, as flawed as he is, and I didn't have much stock to begin with, but, oh, no, that's not true. I think I might have had him second or third in that class. But he's still better. I would still rather have him than what Orlando has at point guard, I would expect.
Yeah.
I mean, Augustine could certainly have a better season. Like that.
I mean, they have Spencer Dinwiddie, too. I mean, I'd rather have Spencer Dinwiddie.
Yeah, I would rather have Spencer Dinwiddie than any of the point guards on the Magic.
But, like, they're not going to ask the point guard to do anything. Like, they're going to just run really basic sort of a lot of stuff through Fournier and Nick Vucevic. Like, I just think that's what's going to happen. Like, their point guard play stinks. And, like, once they get to the point where they have to play anyone good, like, it's going to be exposed. But as far as, like, in an 80 season grind, like, I just think Clipper's going to just not do much, worry much about them.
So,
you know, I don't think it matters that much.
Yeah. Andrew, I have a good news, bad news for you. The good news is I don't think Aaron Gordon's going to play a ton at small forward. But the bad news is I think that's going to happen because they marginalized Jonathan Isaac, and it's going to piss me off. But I just feel like they know at this point Aaron Gordon, like, he just makes more sense there. And Isaac is not so good yet. Maybe he'll be there eventually. He's more of a curiosity at this point to make that sort of push. Like, there are guys who lead to those sorts of circumstances, but I think they have to be much more established. So, like, if Isaac has an awesome training camp or something like that, my instinct, though, is that, yeah, I think Vooch is going to play more than I want him to, and Isaac is going to play less. But that leads to probably a better overall team for the 18-19 season, just because Vooch is a better player right now than Jonathan Isaac is, even though I think I would rather give Isaac more time to see what he is and to go in a more forward direction.
Well, okay, and so this is why I said I would much rather be a Hawks fan right now than a Magic fan, because Orlando has been making these mistakes for years now, where they're like, we're going to win an extra 5 or 10 games and remove ourselves from the conversation for guys at the very top of the draft. And granted, like, with lottery reform this year, maybe that equation changes and maybe this doesn't matter as much. But to me, I just think they've been so myopic with a lot of decisions they've made. Like, I've wanted them to trade Vucevic for like 3 or 4 years now. I mean, he's just not a fit down there, and he should be a sixth man in a Cantor type role for a team that's better. But they just play him to, they're addicted to Vooch. And Fournier, like, when Mike was talking about running pin downs for Fournier, like, I can't watch much more of that, you know?
No,
like,
it's not going to be pretty. They're not going to be a fun team to watch. I do think they're going to have to.
This is such a depressing podcast. It's amazing. I love the Southeast Division.
Here's the thing, though. Like, once upon a time, Orlando was where Atlanta was. And to me, what's interesting is, at what point does Atlanta turn into Orlando or not? Like, what's the stomach for that? You know, because remember back Dwight Howard, Orlando was Atlanta. They were, like, committed to the long rebuild and tearing it down and rebuilding it back up.
I don't know. I don't know if they ever, you know what? That's, I think the best case for what Sam Hinkie did in Philadelphia was pointing at the Magic and looking at them and say, cause they never really committed. That was the problem is they didn't get, I guess you could say the Oladipo pick was pretty high. But like oftentimes what happened with them is they would get to January and then they would sort of like pull the plug on the season and tank, but they would be winning too much. And then when Oladipo was there, like in March and April, he would look great and they would be like, oh, we're finally turning the corner. And Elfrid Payton would have a couple nice games. And that was the problem is they read too much into guys who weren't very good. And they like kind of just cost themselves some really valuable footing in the lottery.
They also picked guys who weren't that good.
Yeah, and some of it's luck, you know?
Well, and I mean, also, I mean, it's very hard. Oladipo is one of the hardest guys to talk about with this because two teams basically, I mean, OKC had a different kind of conversation, but like they saw what they saw with Oladipo and didn't think he had this in him, and then Indiana did, and I didn't see it coming. I will admit, I never saw this Oladipo based on what I had seen.
Nobody did.
And so that it's a weird conversation to have, but I want to also mention that it would be unbelievably funny for me, especially I've done some work on this in the past, if Orlando, of all teams, is the one that benefits from lottery reform because it was Orlando that caused the NBA to go to the system they had before.
Back in the 90s, you mean?
Yeah, in the 90s. Like, Orlando getting Shaq and Penny in consecutive years was what led to lottery reform going steeply for the worst teams. And it is entirely possible that Orlando is going to end up like the 8th or 9th record, get a top 2 or 3 seed, and have people get super pissed off again. And it would make me so unbelievably happy for that to be the case. Because it's just like, that's the way this works. You always, the NBA moves from like one end to the other, and they forget why they moved because it takes so long. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. And so I'm really excited. Like, there are certain reforms, like we talked about at the beginning, where not giving the division winners their stuff, where it's like, okay, this is just a better solution. But then there are sometimes where you're choosing between trade-offs. And I love that they did this, and it very well might end up being Orlando. The only other move I want to talk about briefly is Schroeder. I think that it was very fortunate for Atlanta to get off it. He wasn't a bad contract, but it was just kind of like they were just stuck with him. You know, like it was a circumstance where going through that. So I'm happy with that it turned out that way. We'll see what happens with OKC.
Yeah, I do believe in him as a kind of supporting guy in OKC. I feel like the best conversations we've had on this podcast are about teams that aren't in the Southeast Division, but I'm curious as to whether you guys are buying in on what he can provide the Thunder.
No, not really. No.
I mean,
on the bright side, he's perfectly set up to do what Reggie Jackson did like 2 years ago and embrace the starting role as Westbrook returns from injury and the team stinks and everybody starts to hate him. And then Westbrook comes back and fixes things.
So,
and
yay, Russell Westbrook. We're so happy again.
Setting up for that. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if Westbrook has to miss time due to this knee, the knee procedure that he had, then I understand the Schroeder thing a lot more. But I don't know if that's I don't know if that's going to be the case. Like, he's a much better starting point guard than Raymond Felton, but I think he's a better backup point guard than Raymond Felton, but not that much. And my big concern with Schroeder, we just haven't seen it, is whether he's going to work off ball. Like, Russell Westbrook doesn't. We already pretty much know that. Like, Russell Westbrook, he wants to have it. I mean, it's kind of like the Pucci thing. Either the ball is in his hands, or we're all talking about why the ball isn't in his hands. So that is a constraint, But yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how that works out. Very quickly, I mean, I think the best newcomer in this division is probably Dwight Howard. That makes me intensely sad. I mean, there are guys that will be better long-term, but in terms of this year's value, it probably is Dwight, isn't it?
You know, the only other nomination I would have, which isn't really, it doesn't count, but I am curious about Malik Monk in Charlotte, and I almost feel like last season was like a redshirt season for him, and I want to know whether he's just going to be bad in the NBA. I mean, he had some moments. He definitely had a couple like great quarters thrown in there. But that's the X factor I am curious about with Charlotte is he going to arrive and be a real player for them? And because I loved watching him at Kentucky, I had no idea how much of that was going to translate in the NBA. But it would be fun to see him in a role where he actually matters with the Hornets.
I was going to say Trae Young, but I think other than Dwight, that's probably the number one, I would say, as top newcomer, or Steve Clifford in terms of the win-loss record, but not in terms of where your team is going. Yeah, I would probably say Trae Young is probably the one that is most interesting.
So Mike, I know that you have to go. We've been running for a little while. So I'll give you the floor for just a bit to say the rookie you're most excited to see, and then if you have any like breakout candidates, whether they're rookies or whoever else, like guys that you think are going to do well, and then Sharp and I can finish out the rest of it.
Yeah, Trae Young, for all the reasons that I think we've talked about, I'm just sort of curious what I'm getting there. So I'm definitely excited to see him. Breakout candidates, Jonathan Isaac was a good one. I think that would be probably the one I'd go with. I'm also intrigued to see if Winslow or Bam Adebayo kind of really does capitalize on their promise. But the division is not exactly littered with either of these sort of situations. I just don't think Mo Bamba is going to play very much this year. And we know what we're getting from the Wizards guys. And other than, John Collins might be an interesting breakout player that like five people are going to watch blossom into a really good player. Because I think he could be really good.
John Collins was a lot of fun to watch last year. He definitely, he got hurt midway through and sort of fell off the map a little bit. But I think he was better than a lot of people expected. And what I liked about him is that he at least once or twice every game would try to dunk on the entire team he was playing. And I love him for that. And I think he is actually going to be good. I don't know whether you can like win a title with a big man like that, but he's going to be very solid.
Yeah, I'm impressed by him. I mean, for the dunking thing, I can just watch highlights of him dunking on people. But I actually think he has some game, especially in the short role, and he showed some perimeter stuff in summer league. I think him and Trae Young could be a really fun little partnership that all of us who watch way too much basketball can show off our knowledge by pointing out with other people that don't watch the Hawks as much. So I'm also excited for that.
It's always fun. I think Collins is an interesting one. I wonder a little bit about what his position is long term, but the Hawks are going to be bad enough that I don't think it matters. So we can just see what he plays, how well that works out. And sometimes that's good for young players, just from an evaluation standpoint, that there's not going to be a lot on his shoulders. I want to see what he can be defensively. You know, like, is he more of a shot blocker? He has great second jump, so his rebounding will be good, but it's just kind of where he fits in there, maybe as a switch guy too. But then a guy that Andrew and I both really like is Bam Adebayo. And it's funny because, like, Hassan Whiteside has a lot of positives, but his negatives get a lot of attention. And I think Bam could end up being a much better player for Miami, even in the near term, just because he takes less off the table. And so he might add less, but taking less off could be exactly what Miami needs.
Yeah, you know, and I just wonder with Bam how much room they're going to have to just straight up sit Whiteside and be like, you know what, we understand you're making $25 million a year, but you're playing 15 minutes tonight, and we're going to run out Bam for 30 minutes. Like, there were stretches in that Sixers series where Bam was doing a pretty nice job on Embiid, and it's really fun to watch him on defense. And then on offense, I think that he has a little bit more versatility to his game than we've even seen last year. And so I'm all in, man. I think the Bam bandwagon is pretty small right now, but I'm glad to hear that you're on it.
I am, at least for the time being, and I'm intrigued to see. Offensively, he's just has a little bit more capability than I think people have, and this is something that happens with John Calipari big men, is that, you're like, yeah, they can actually do a lot more, just because Cal doesn't need to ask them to do that. Now, I understand that. You know, I'm not ripping on Calipari for that, necessarily. And
no, it's actually really funny, though, because before the draft, I was talking to scouts who were very high on Bam, and I had only seen him at Kentucky, and I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Are you kidding me? Like, he's a rim runner who's undersized and basically has nothing but, like, the ability to dunk on offense. And it was that first summer league that actually did it for me, where I was like, wait a second, this is not the guy we saw at Kentucky. Like, let's see where this goes.
A couple other quick ones. I think people are going to remember this year that Cody Zeller is a good basketball player, which is, it'd be funny for him to break out, because I'm not necessarily sure he'll be better than he was in 16-17, but he got marginalized last year by Dwight and having to play with the worst bench lineup for a lot of the year that basically existed. And along those lines, this isn't a breakout guy, but I'm interested to see what happens with Tony Parker there, just because he'll be better than MCW, because everybody pretty much is better than MCW was last year. But then the other guy, and this is a good one to talk with you about, is I hope Kelly Oubre gets the opportunity to have a nice year, because, I mean, it's a big one for him with the, you know, extension negotiations early in it. I assume he's going to be a restricted free agent, and I could see him having a nice year.
Yeah, you know, Oubre is a tough one, because he has all the sort of aesthetics of, like, everything you would want in a modern wing, and he checks all the right boxes, but he also is just a little bit underwhelming in a number of ways. His defense isn't quite as good as it sometimes appears. Like, he looks like a great defender, but then he kind of spaces out for a quarter or two quarters, and like, he's not playable. And like, a guy like Satoransky is oftentimes more helpful than Oubre has been, and Oubre's shooting fell off a cliff over the final few months last season. So I'm not optimistic, to be honest with you, but I am curious, because there's certainly a possibility that he turns into sort of a poor man's version of what Jaylen Brown has been in Boston, and that's a really good player, you know. And the market in restricted free agency is a whole other discussion, but like, it is a huge year for him, and I'm curious to see where he goes.
And what kind of opportunity he gets, and we talked about that earlier with Scott Brooks, and yeah.
Well, the opportunities, though.
Like, that's true.
I think he gets his minutes in part because there's not really any alternative on the wing behind Otto, but it's a question of how consistent he can be. He'll have one night every 10 days where you're like, whoa, Oubre is great, and it's a matter of sustaining that.
And what, obviously, you can interject with any other breakout guys. I think that's pretty much the full list, at least, of guys that I was really thinking about. I would love to see, you know, depending on what young guys get playing time in this division, there are other ones, but I don't expect it. Usually, rookies and sophomores aren't super good. Like, that's part of why the Hawks are probably going to be bad this year. But we get into just, it's a basic question, but just ranking these teams 1 to 5.
To me, I've got the Wizards number one. I've got the Heat number two. I've got the Hornets number three, and the Magic number four, and the Hawks number five. And it's perverse, but I do feel like the Hawks might have the most hope of anyone in this division. I'm really excited for the Wizards season. I think that they are going to be better than a lot of people realize, and we'll probably finish maybe fourth in the East, fourth or fifth. Having said that, though, that, like, I think that there's a cloud hanging over the team because everyone knows what's coming in the next couple years, and like, that Supermax just really complicates a lot of things, both literally in free agency, but also just sort of how fans feel about where the team is going and what the possibilities are. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of like the chalkiest prediction, but that's what I've got in the Southeast.
That's the same order I'd have too. I think Washington-Miami is tighter just because both of those teams have a little bit of variability on kind of where it turns out. Like, Miami, if their offense is even a little bit better than it was, then they could be, you know, if they have a top 10 defense and a league average offense, like Portland. So, for example, last year, Portland was 7-15. So they were 7th in defense, 15th in offense, and they had a +2 point differential, which is good. And Miami was a little bit below that, if they could get that offense better. But I'm not sure at all that that's going to happen. We've talked about the issues there. And Washington, you know, I could see them doing a little bit better on both ends of the floor. We talked about John Wall only played half the season. They have, you know, I think they're a deeper team this coming season, which could really help. It depends on really what they get from Jeff Green versus Mike Scott, who had an underappreciated year, because Austin Rivers, I think, is going to help them as long as Scott Brooks uses him in a reasonable way. And then, you know, like I think Charlotte was something we didn't talk about when Mike was still on the call, was that possibility that they move on from Kemba. He brought it up as a possibility.
Yeah, that's smart.
I don't expect them to do that, even though I think they should. I think they should have traded Kemba at the deadline last year. You know, I could see this as just them writing it out, thinking that he could resign, and he very well might resign. But that, I think that is the easiest way. So the two real changes in order here for me. One is, you know, Miami could just be a little bit better. Washington, I think Washington, my expectation is Washington. I have the same order that you do. And then the other one would be if Charlotte sees where this is going and trades Kemba. And then my expectation would be that even is that they would then finish behind Orlando. But remember, that would be halfway through the season. So they would still probably, I think they would be ahead of Orlando in the standings at that juncture.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, the Kemba stuff, I don't even know what you can get for Kemba at this point, which is the problem. And that was the problem at the last All-Star break too. And it's just kind of a purgatory that a number of teams find themselves in for various reasons. I mean, I would say that the Grizzlies would have dealt Gasol or Conley somewhere along the way over the past few years if they could get anything close to the value of that those guys provide by being in Memphis. And I wonder if some of the same stuff is in play with Kemba, where, like, you know, do you trade Kemba for like a mid first round pick and a bad contract? Like, probably not, but that's a nice depressing note to end on actually for this division, is like, they're kind of screwed either way, but at least the Wizards will have Dwight and are going to be the most toxic team in the league, and we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, I think there is a possibility that there's a little bit more variance here. I would love to see, like, Orlando take a big step. I wish I were as optimistic as Preda is. I'm not quite there yet. But, you know, there are players and teams that can defy it. And sometimes, from my experience, when you think something is figured out, I think a good example of this is the Indiana Pacers last year. I mean, granted, Oladipo that's not precedent for anything. But sometimes that leads to things, because we get really comfortable with the idea that players are going to be the same year in, year out. And guys grow, guys develop. And hopefully, if anybody does in this division, they will get the opportunity to show it.
Yep. There you go. We'll see.
Slightly sunnier ending. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, man. It was a lot of fun. And I look forward to, maybe we could do another West Coast, East Coast pod somewhere in the middle of season.
Thanks again to Andrew Sharp and Mike Preda for taking the time to come on. You can, of course, read Andrew and listen to him involving Sports Illustrated. He is actually the ombudsman of the big top 100 players thing that came out. So he got to spend some quality time with Ben Golver and Rob Mahoney, who have been on earlier iterations of these division podcasts. And they just put out that big feature. A lot of good work that went into that. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Sharp, AndrewSharp. And Mike Preda, editor of SB Nation NBA. They do great work. And his Twitter handle is Mike Preda SBN, M-I-K-E, I can talk, P-R-A-D-A SBN. And I'm such a big fan of all the work that they're doing over there. And I love talking with Mike. The tentative plan for the rest of September is to hopefully get the over-unders and a Real GM Radio tradition done. It's not locked in all the way yet, but it's pretty close. So that's the expectation. And by the time that's done, if that ends up being the timeline here, we'll be getting close to the season. And I'm really looking forward to that. So really start getting there in earnest. Haven't exactly figured out where I'm going to go from there, but have a couple weeks to figure it out. And for those of you who want to hear me more, I am actually taking over, because Nate is on his honeymoon, I am running Dunked On for 2 whole weeks. That will start with Sunday night / Monday morning's episode and continue for the following 2 weeks. And then as soon as that is resolved, Nate and I are going back to 5 days a week. So you can enjoy that, doing the team previews for a bunch of the different episodes. And so a lot of fun. I've actually done a portion of those already and then recording the rest over the next few days. So looking forward to that. Have a bunch of work in the offing for various outlets. I don't know how close any of it is to publishing, but it is in process, because I take my time sometimes with things in the summer. I am planning and everything like that. So
If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the best way to do it. And the best way to support the show is to check out our sponsors, betonline.ag. Use the promo code podcast1, using the number 1, for a 50% sign-up bonus. Pluto TV, the leading free streaming television service, which is pretty cool. And TrueCar, great place to buy new and used cars. And then the other ways to support the show, I mean, I don't mention this enough, but word of mouth is extremely important. Just telling people you liked either this episode, the show in total, that can be on social media, that can be in person, whatever makes you happy. I really do appreciate it. Leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast player of your choice. Great if it's Apple. If it's not, if you want to be super awesome, you can do it in both. And then subscribing, downloading every episode. That's important with Real GM Radio because it comes out on completely random days because of guest availability and when I get a chance to edit it. So it's always going to come out within a given week, but what day changes. So if you subscribe, then you don't have to wait for a tweet or something like that. You could just have it pop into your podcast player whenever you're ready for it. So looking forward to a little bit less than a month of more idle time, and a fair portion of that is actually going to have preseason basketball. And preseason basketball has its flaws, but it's better than no basketball, to be certain. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.